Welcome back to the Hemingway List. You guys, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway List way, you guys. today we're talking about The Brothers Karamazov, Book 6, Chapter 3, Part F. And then we'll be reading the next bit, Part G. And I asked you guys, regarding Part F, to what extent do you agree with Zosso's point here? Swim said the Mumba Fishy had this to say. This may be an unpopular opinion, but I'm more than ready to get back to the main plot. What's up with the brothers and et al? I feel like I'm back at mass, wishing the priest would wrap up the homily already. FX Delta D said that they agree. I wonder why Dostoevsky decided to put this section here rather than when Zosima is first introduced. Uncle Drosselmeyer came in, pointing out that it is a technique, literary technique, used to build up tension. Many authors make use of that. The first time I noticed it was when I read The Godfather, Mario Puzo, and Consigliere, Tom Hagen, told the bad news about Sonny to Don Corleone. This was at the end of a chapter, and I was in shock, and I wanted to know more, but the next chapters were about the childhood of Don Corleone, or about Michael in Sicilia. I almost had a heart attack. Is that the technique they're using here? Putting the backstory in for Zosso at this point? Techrific said, well, despite all evidence to the contrary, I am also... I feel like I'm back at mass, wishing the priest would wrap up. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, so am I, says Techrific. Sorry, read that wrong. A promise of a patricide was made in the early chapters. We are almost 400 pages in, and I'm not a bloodthirsty sort of fellow, but I'm ready for a crime, the crime part, to commence. Yeah, some sort of like a plot would be good, if there was like things that happened in the book. I remember there was one bit where a kid was getting bullied and he throwing rocks, and that was almost like a little plot for a moment there, but then they just started talking about religion again. I am a Norwegian, said I have loved these last couple of chapters, but I agree, especially since they are finally all colliding in the main story. Uncle Josmeyer said, everything is according to plan, believe me, it's a narrative technique. Also, many things said here could be useful to have in mind in the next chapters. Techrific said, I feel Dosto is showing a lot of insight into the human heart. He's also prescient in certain things, especially foretelling the bloody revolution that's coming. However, I think he's creating false dichotomy between enlightenment, progress, science, liberal and the romantic movement, religious conservative strains. Nothing is ever as clear-cut as saying the richer this and that, and the poorer that and this. It's an unhelpful oversimplification. We all have both these tendencies in us, and it changes over time. Sometimes we're more conservative and cautious and reticent to change, and sometimes we're more open, progressive, etc. Creating this imaginary rift in our societies is detrimental. We also tend to overcomplicate morality. If you need an anchor to pin your morals on, choosing a Godhead is a first step only. All your moral work is still ahead of you. If you are a Christian, it starts with the Mosaic laws, but those laws are specific to their times, just as much as our laws are specific to our times. Slavery is condoned both in the Old Testament and the New. If you hinge your morality to those revelations, you are immoral according to our laws today. Therefore, your anchor is lost, or if you choose to reject certain of God's laws and only keep the ones you agree with, you're more of a moral relativist than any Western nation. Morals are quite simple, if you have empathy. Pinning them to the Bronze Age, wisdom, is merely digging a hole for yourself. This is how Zosima's mother can be supremely upset about Markel's teenage atheism, but not about selling an elderly human being for money because she no longer has use of her. That said, I think Dosto is correct when he says that true equality is to be found in the spiritual dignity of man. Human dignity is very important. The incident with Afanasy Pavlovich giving Zosima 50 kopecks for the monastery showed Zosima that he that it's through human dignity that the bond between people of different circumstances is forged. Ivan Norwegian said, Dostoevsky isn't talking about Christian ethics as a series of injunctions to be compared or contrasted with secular injunctions. This is just the low state of the discussion as you see on TV and Reddit. If we abandon Christian ethics, people will be effing in the streets and will all devolve. Shut up, Grandpa. Your outdated laws have been holding us back for hundreds of years. The way Zosima has spoken about ethics so far, especially early on in the book, on his discussions about criminals, and what would happen if God exists, makes it seem to me like he is talking about the metaphysical consequences of an existence of God. I implicitly made the case, in my comment on this chapter, that Christian injunctions, especially nowadays, are not that different from other bodies of injunctions. Jesus or the apostles didn't introduce completely novel new laws. What they insisted on were much older than them, eternal. When you convert someone to Christianity, you do not convert them into submission or a series of injunctions, but to the Christian faith. You are right, though. Faith is not really a solution to the question of morality, but only a first step. I do question if it's the first step, one of the few roads that will actually get you where you want to go, though. I'm Norwegian also said this. I just listened to the podcast, and I'm not sure if it's entirely fair to say that Christianity has held us back, or that science would be much further ahead without religion. Long, long ago, religion was the great unifier, the antidote to tribalism. Then, further ahead, it was the impetus driving monks and Christians in the search of truth, while Nietzsche described as the rope which God hung himself with. Bacon himself, the father of the scientific method, was a devout Christian. That's not to say that religion cannot be repressive and regressive, but I don't think that it was at its core. Historians don't use the term Dark Ages anymore because it is misleading and inaccurate. Other misconceptions, such as the church prohibited autopsies and dissecting during the Middle Ages, the rise of Christianity killed off ancient science, and the medieval Christian church suppressed the growth of natural philosophy, are cited by numbers of examples of myths that still pass as historical truth, although unsupported by current research. Though I can't blame you for using the term. I'm pretty sure I was taught it in school, and you bump into it everywhere in popular media. Yeah. Did I say Dark Ages? I probably did. I think I meant to say like the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. What came before the Middle Ages? The whatever it was called. I'm no historian. Anyway, you're probably right. I'm definitely wrong. I know that much. But yeah, I don't know. I was just having a little rant. Thanks for setting me straight. This reminds me of earlier in the book when Zosima argued that the criminal in Russia still feared God and excommunication, said Norwegian. And that, by the way, for them, were back towards the church, rather than mechanical and surgical excision from society. I do think there is truth to the notion that behaving as though God is real is good. Behaving as though your every action matters. You will still be seen as a good person by society, friends and family, if I just stole when no one was watching. Not so if you believe in something transcendent. Yeah, but then, what's with all the forgiveness stuff? The reason I think Christianity worked the way it worked is because the punishment for doing something that goes against God's rules is that you have to repent. And it's not that bad, really, as a punishment. Like, if you pray for forgiveness, then you're good. If you confess in, you know, the Catholic setting, then you're fine. God will forgive you and you can still go to heaven. Why? Because I think if the punishment is bad, people feel like that's just a payment for doing the action that they want to do, but they're prohibited from doing. I really want to covet my neighbor's wife or whatever the thing is, but the punishment for that is 7 punches in the face from a monk. Okay, I'm going to covet my neighbor's wife, and then I'll take those 7 punches, and then I'll feel like all's even in the world. That's the price you pay. But when the price you pay is minimal, you just have to say sorry, then it doesn't feel like you squared it away. It feels like you did something bad, but the world didn't punish you. And that's a very uncomfortable feeling. You know what I mean? Because you feel guilty about the bad thing you do. If you get a just punishment about the thing that you should feel guilty for, it alleviates the guilt. But if you never do get justice served to you, then you kind of keep that guilt. Maybe. I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, let's read the next bit of the book, hey? Let's move ahead and read part G, which goes exactly like this. Where is it? Just to find the page. Oh, here it is. It's called Of Prayer, of Love, and of Contact with Other Worlds. Young man, be not forgetful of prayer. Every time you pray, if your prayer is sincere, there will be new feeling and new meaning in it, which will give you fresh courage, and you will understand that prayer is an education. Remember too every day, and whenever you can, repeat to yourself, Lord, have mercy on all who appear before thee today. For every hour and every moment, thousands of men leave life on this earth, and their souls appear before God. And how many of them depart in solitude, unknown, sad, dejected, that no one mourns for them, or even knows where they have lived or not. And behold, from the other end of the earth, perhaps your prayer for their rest will rise up to God, though you knew them not, nor they knew you. How touching it must be to a soul standing in dread before the Lord to feel at that instant that for him too there is one to pray, that there is a fellow creature left on earth to love him too. And God will look on you both with more graciously, for if you have had so much pity on him, how much will he have pity who is infinitely more loving and merciful than you, and he will forgive him for your sake. Brothers, have no fear of men's sin. Love a man even in his sin, for that is the semblance of divine love, and is the highest love on earth. Love all God's creation, the whole and every grain of sand in it. Love every leaf, every ray of God's light. Love the animals, love the plants, love everything. If you love everything, you will perceive the divine mystery in things. Once you perceive it, you will begin to comprehend it better every day, and you will come at last to love the whole world with an all-embracing love. Love the animals. God has given them the rudiments of thought and joy untroubled. Do not trouble it. Don't harass them. Don't deprive them of their happiness. Don't work against God's intent. Man, do not pride yourself on superiority to the animals. They are without sin, and you, with your greatness, defile the earth by your appearance on it and leave the traces of your foulness after you. Alas, it is true of almost every one of us. Love children especially, for they too are sinless like the angels. They live to soften and purify our hearts, and as it were to guide us. Woe to him who offends a child. Father Anfim taught me to love children. The kind, silent man used often on our wanderings to spend the farthings given us on sweets and cakes for the children. He could not pass by a child without emotion. That's the nature of the man. At some thoughts, one stands perplexed, especially at the sight of men's sin, and wonders whether one should use force or humble love. Always decide to use humble love. If you resolve on that once and for all, you may subdue the whole world. Loving humility is marvelously strong and the strongest of all things, and there is nothing else like it. Every day and every hour, every minute, walk around yourself and watch yourself and see that your image is a seemly one. You pass by a little child, you pass by spiteful, the ugly, with ugly words, with wrathful heart. You may not have noticed the child, but he has seen you, and your image, unseemly and ignoble, may remain in his defenceless heart. You don't know it, but you may have sown an evil seed in him, and it may grow, and all because you were not careful before the child, because you did not foster in yourself a careful, actively benevolent love. Brothers, love is a teacher, but one must know how to acquire it, for it is hard to acquire. It is dearly bought, it is won slowly by long labour, for we must love not only occasionally for a moment, but forever. Everyone can love occasionally, even the wicked can. My brother asked the birds to forgive him. That sounds senseless, but it is right. For all is like an ocean, all is flowing and blending. A touch in one place sets up movement at the other end of the earth. It may be senseless to beg forgiveness of the birds, but the birds would be happier at your side, a little happier anyway, and children and all animals, if you were nobler than you are now. It's all like an ocean, I tell you. Then you would pray to the birds too, consumed by an all-embracing love, in a sort of transport, and pray that they too will forgive you your sin. Treasure this ecstasy, however senseless it may seem to men. My friends, pray to God for gladness. Be glad as children, as the birds of heaven, and let not the sin of men confound you in your doings. Fear not that it will wear away your work, or hinder its being accomplished. Do not say, sin is mighty, wickedness is mighty, evil environment is mighty, and we are lonely and helpless, and evil environment is wearing us away, hindering our good work from being done. Fly from that dejection, children. There is only one means of salvation. Then take yourself and make yourself responsible for all men's sins. That is the truth, you know, friends, for as soon as you sincerely make yourself responsible for everything and for all men, you will see at once that it is really so, and that you are to blame for everyone and for all things. By throwing your own indolence and impotence on others, you will end by sharing the pride of Satan and murmuring against God. Of the pride of Satan, what I think is this. It is hard for us on earth to comprehend it, and therefore it is so easy to fall into error and to share it, even imagining that we are doing something grand and fine. Indeed, many of the strongest feelings and movements of our nature we cannot comprehend on earth. Let not that be a stumbling block, and think not that it may serve as a justification to you for anything. For the eternal judge asks you what you can comprehend and not what you cannot. You will know that yourself hereafter, for you will behold all things truly then, and will not dispute them. On earth, indeed, we are, as it were, astray, and if it were not for the precious image of Christ before us, we should be undone and altogether lost, as was the human race before the flood. Much on earth is hidden from us, but to make up for that, we have been given a precious mystic sense for our living bond with the other world, with the higher heavenly world, and the roots of our thoughts and feelings are not here but in other worlds. That is why the philosophers say that we cannot apprehend the reality of things on earth. God took seeds from different worlds and sowed them on this earth, and his garden grew up and everything came up that could come up, but what grows, lives, and is alive only through the feeling of its contact with the mysterious worlds. If that feeling grows weak or is destroyed in you, the heavenly growth will die away in you. Then you will be indifferent to life and even grow to hate it. That's what I think. Alright, there we go. That's the end of the chapter. Okay. I do feel like I'm in a sermon or something at the moment and just struggling to listen to the guy that does the talking at the front of the thing, whatever they're called, the sermoner. Yeah, I'm falling asleep at the pew. Anyway, have your say about this chapter. Head over to reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. And I look forward to seeing what you've got to say. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.